Chapter 8. The torrent came with a roar louder than thunder and flung Pitt to the deck. He instinctively held his breath as the icy water surged over and around him. He clung desperately to the pedestal of the control console to keep from being swept over the side into the maelstrom. He felt as if he had dropped over a towering cascade. All he could see through his face mask was a billow of bubbles and foam. Even in his Arctic dry suit, the cold felt like a million sharp needles stabbing his skin. He thought his arms were being pulled from their sockets as he clung for his life. Then Polar Queen struggled up and burst through the back of the wave, her bow forging another 10 meters to port. She was refusing to die, game to fight the sea to the bitter end. The water drained from the bridge in rivers until Pitt's head surfaced into the air again. He took a deep breath and tried to stare through the downpour of water that splashed back from the black rock of the cliffs. God, they seemed so close he could spit on them. So close that foam thrown upward by the horrendous collision of water against rock rebounded and fell over the ship like a cloudburst. The ship was a beam of the chaos, and he eased back on the stern thruster in an attempt to quarter the surge. The bow thruster dug in and shouldered the forward part of the ship into the flood as the stern screws thrashed the water into foam, pushing her on an angle away from the vertical rock face. Imperceptibly, but by the grace of God, her bow was edging out to sea. "She's coming about!" Giordino yelled from above. "She's coming about!" "We're not out of the woods yet." For the first time since the inundation, Pitt had the luxury of replying. He warily eyed the next sequence of waves that came rolling in. The sea wasn't through with the Polar Queen yet. Pitt ducked as a huge sheet of spray crashed over the bridge wing. The next comber struck like an express train before colliding with the backwash from the last one. Bludgeoned by the impact from two sides, the ship was tossed upward until her hull was visible almost to the keel. Her twin screws rose into the air, throwing white water that reflected the sun like sparks of a fireworks pinwheel. She hung suspended for a terrible moment, finally dropping into a deep trough before she was struck by the next breaker in line. The bow was jerked to starboard, but the thruster battled her back on course. Again and again the cruise ship heeled over as the waves rolled against the sides of her hull. There was no stopping her now. She was through the worst of it and shook off the endless swells as though she were a dog shaking water off its coat. The hungry sea might take her another time, but more likely she would end up at the scrappers 30 or more years from now. But this day she still sailed the brutal waters.
"You pulled it off! You really pulled it off!" shouted Giordino as though he didn't believe his eyes.
Pitt sagged against the bridge wing railing and felt suddenly tired. It was then he became conscious of a pain in his right hip. He recalled striking against a stanchion that supported a nightlight when he was immersed by the giant wave. He couldn't see under the dry suit, but he knew that his skin was forming a beautiful bruise. Only after he set the navigation controls for a straight course south into the Weddell Sea did he turn and gaze at the pile of rock that towered above the sea like a jagged black column. There was an angry look about the cold face of the precipice, almost as if it were enraged at being cheated out of a victim. The barren island soon became little more than a pile of sea-ravaged rock as it receded in Polar Queen's wake. Pitt looked up as the turquoise helicopter hovered over the wheelhouse.
"How's your fuel?" he asked Giordino.
"Enough to make Ice Hunter with a few liters to spare," Giordino answered.
"You'd better be on your way, then." "Did you ever stop to think that if you board and sail an abandoned ship into the nearest port, you'd make a few million bucks from the insurance underwriters on a salvage contract?"
Pitt laughed.
"Do you really think Admiral Sandecker and the United States government would allow a poor but honest bureaucrat to keep the pay without screaming?"
"Probably not. Can I do anything for you?"
"Just give Dempsey my position and tell him I'll rendezvous at whatever position he chooses."
"See you soon," Giordino signed off.
He was tempted to make a joke about Pitt's having an entire cruise ship to himself, but the reality of the situation quickly set in. There could be no joy at knowing you were the only one alive on a ship of the dead. He did not envy Pitt for even 1 second as he swung the helicopter into a turn and set a course for the ice hunter. Pitt removed his helmet and watched as the turquoise helicopter flew low across the blue, ice-cold sea. He watched until it became a speck on the golden-blue horizon. A fleeting sense of loneliness shrouded him as he gazed around the empty ship. How long he stood gazing across the decks devoid of life, he never recalled. He stood there as if stalling, his mind blank. He was waiting for some sort of sound besides the slap of the waves against the bow and the steady beat of the engines. Maybe he waited for a sound that indicated the presence of people, voices, or laughter. Maybe he waited for some sign of movement from something other than the ship's pennants flapping in the breeze. More likely, he was seized by foreboding about what he would most certainly find. Already the scene at the Argentinian research station was being played out again. The dead passengers and crew, soaked through and sprawled on the upper decks, were only a sample of what he expected to find in the quarters and staterooms below. At last he pulled his mind back on track and entered the wheelhouse. He set the engines on half speed and plotted an approximate course toward an interception point with Ice Hunter. Then he programmed the coordinates into the navigation computer and engaged the automated ship's control system, linking it with the radar to self-steer the ship around any passing icebergs. Assured the ship was in no further danger, he stepped from the wheelhouse. Several of the bodies on the outer decks were crewmen who died in the act of maintaining the ship. Two were painting bulkheads. Others had been working on the lifeboats. The bodies of 8 passengers suggested that they had been admiring the unspoiled shoreline when they were struck down. Pitt walked down a passageway and looked in the ship's hospital. It was empty, as was the health club. He took the carpeted stairs down to the boat deck, which held the ship's 6 suites. They were all empty except one. An elderly woman lay as if sleeping. He touched her neck with his fingers. She was as cold as ice. He moved down to the salon deck. Pitt began to feel like the Ancient Mariner on a ship of ghosts. The only thing missing was an albatross around his neck. The generators were still supplying electricity and heat. Everything was orderly and everything in place. The interior warmth of the ship felt good after the inundation of icy water on the bridge wing. He was mildly surprised to find he had become immune to the dead bodies. He no longer bothered to closely examine them to see if there was a spark of life. He knew the tragic truth. Though mentally prepared, he still found it hard to believe there was no life on board. That death had swept through the ship like a gust of wind was foreign to everything he'd ever experienced. It became most uncomfortable for him to intrude into the life of a ship that had known happier memories. He idly wondered what future passengers and crew would think, cruising on a jinxed ship. Would no one sail on her ever again? Or would the tragedy attract sell-out crowds in search of adventure mixed with morbidness? Suddenly he paused, cocked an ear, and listened. Piano music was drifting from somewhere within the ship. He recognized the piece as an old jazz tune called Sweet Lorraine. Then, as suddenly as the music began, it stopped. Pitt began to sweat under the dry suit. He paused for a couple of minutes and stripped it off. The dead won't mind me walking around in my thermal underwear, he thought in grim humor. He pushed on. He wandered into the kitchen. The area around the ovens and preparation tables was littered with the corpses of the chefs, ordinary kitchen help and waiters, lying 2 and 3 deep. There was a cold horror about the place. It looked like a charnel house, but without the blood. Nothing but shapeless, lifeless forms frozen in their final act of clutching something tangible as if an unseen force were trying to drag them away. Pitt turned away, sickened, and rode the kitchen elevator up to the dining salon. The tables were set for a meal unserved. Silverware, scattered by the ship's violent motion, still lay on immaculately clean tablecloths. Death must have arrived just prior to the seating for the lunchtime meal. He picked up a menu and studied the entrees. Sea bass, Antarctic ice fish, toothfish, a giant cod, and veal steak for those without a taste for fish. He laid the menu on the table and was about to leave when he spotted something that was out of place. He stepped over the body of a waiter and walked to a table by one of the picture windows. Someone had eaten here. Pitt stared at the dishes that still had scraps of food on them. There was a nearly empty bowl of what looked like clam chowder, broken rolls smeared with butter, and a half-consumed glass of iced tea. It was as though someone had just finished lunch and left for a stroll around the deck. Had they opened the dining salon early for someone, he wondered. He rejected any thought that suggested a passenger had eaten here after the death plague struck. Pitt tried to write off the intriguing discovery with a dozen different logical solutions, but subconsciously a fear began to grow. Unthinkingly, he began to look over his shoulder every so often. He left the dining salon and moved past the gift shop and worked forward into the ship's lounge. A Steinway grand piano was situated beside a small wooden dance floor. Chairs and tables were spaced around the lounge in a horseshoe arrangement. Besides the cocktail waitress who had fallen while carrying a tray of drinks, there was a party of 8 men and women, mostly in their early 70s, who had been seated around a large table, but now lay in grotesque positions on the carpet. As he studied the husbands and wives, some locked in a final embrace, Pitt experienced sadness and anguish at the same time. Overwhelmed with a sense of helplessness, he cursed the unknown cause of such a terrible tragedy. Then he noticed another corpse. It was a woman sitting on the carpet in one corner of the lounge. Her chin was on her knees, head cradled in her arms. Dressed in a fashionable short-sleeved leather jacket and wool slacks, she was not in a contorted position, nor did she appear to have vomited like all the others. Pitt's nerves reacted by sending a cold shiver up his spine. His heart sprinted from a slow, steady beat to a rapid pace. Gathering control over his initial shock, he moved slowly across the room until he stood looking down on her. He reached out and touched her cheek with a light, exploring fingertip, experiencing an incredible wave of relief as he felt warmth. He gently shook her by the shoulders and saw her eyelids quiver open. At first she looked at him dazed and uncomprehending, and then her eyes flew wide. She threw her arms around him and gasped, "You're alive!" "You don't know how happy I am to see you are, too," Pitt said softly, his lips parted in a smile. Abruptly, she pulled back from him.
"No, no, you can't be real. You're all dead."
"You needn't be afraid of me," he said in a soothing tone. She stared at him through wide brown eyes rimmed red from weeping, a sad, enigmatic gaze. Her facial complexion was flawless, but there was an unmistakable pallor and just a hint of gauntness. Her hair was the color of red copper. She had the high cheekbones and full sculptured lips of a fashion model. Their eyes locked for a moment, and then he dropped his stare slightly. From what he could tell about her in her curled position, she had a fashion model's figure. Her bared arms looked muscular for a woman. Only when she lowered her eyes and peered at his body did he suddenly feel embarrassed to be standing in front of a lady in his long johns.
"Why aren't you properly dressed?" she finally murmured.
It was an inconsequential question bred from a state of fear and trauma, not curiosity. Pitt didn't bother to explain. "Better yet, you tell me who you are and how you survived when the others died." She looked as if she were about to fall over on her side, so he quickly bent down, circled his arm around her waist, and lifted her into a leather chair next to a table. He walked over to the bar. He went behind the bar, expecting to find the body of the bartender, and was not disappointed. He took a bottle of Jack Daniel's Old Number 7 Tennessee Sour Mash whiskey from a mirrored shelf and poured a shot glass. "Drink this," he said, holding the glass to her lips.
"I don't drink," she protested vaguely.
"Consider it medicinal. Just take a few sips." She managed to consume the contents of the glass without coughing,
but her face twisted into a sour expression as the whiskey, smooth as summer's kiss to a connoisseur, inflamed her tonsils. After she had gasped a few breaths of air, she looked into his sensitive green eyes and sensed his compassion.
"My name is Deirdre Dorset," she whispered nervously.
"Go on," he prompted. "That's a start. Are you one of the passengers?" She shook her head.
"An entertainer. I sing and play the piano in the lounge."
"That was you playing Sweet Lorraine."
"Call it a reaction from shock. Shock at seeing everyone dead. Shock at thinking it would be my turn next. I can't believe I'm still alive."
"Where were you when the tragedy occurred?" She peered at the four couples lying nearby in morbid fascination.
"The lady in the red dress and the silver-haired man were celebrating their 50th anniversary with friends who accompanied them on the cruise. The night before their private party, the kitchen staff had carved a heart and Cupid out of ice to sit in the middle of a bowl of champagne punch. While Fred, he's..."
She corrected herself.
"He was the bartender, opened the champagne, and Marta, the waitress, brought in a crystal bowl from the kitchen. I volunteered to bring the ice carving from the storage freezer."
"You were in the freezer?" She nodded silently. "Do you recall if you latched the door behind you?"
"Its wings closed automatically."
"You could lift and carry the ice carving by yourself?"
"It wasn't very large, about the size of a small garden pot."
"Then what did you do?" She closed her eyes very tightly, then pressed her hands against them and whispered,
"I was only in there for a few minutes. When I came out, I found everyone on the ship dead."
"Exactly how many minutes would you say?" Pitt asked softly.
She moved her head back and forth and spoke through her hands. "Why are you asking me all these questions?"
"I don't mean to sound like a prosecuting attorney, but please, it's important." Slowly she lowered her hands and stared vacantly at the surface of the table.
"I don't know. I have no way of knowing exactly how long I was in there. All I remember is it took me a little while to wrap the ice carving in a couple of towels so I could get a good grip on it and carry it without freezing my fingers."
"You were very lucky," he said. "Yours is a classic example of being in the right place at the right time. If you had stepped from the freezer 2 minutes before you did, you'd be as dead as all the others. You were doubly lucky I came on board the ship when I did."
"Are you one of the crew? You don't look familiar."
It was obvious to him she was not fully aware of the Polar Queen's near brush with the Danger Islands. "I'm sorry, I should have introduced myself. My name is Dirk Pitt. I'm with a research expedition. We found your excursion party where they had been abandoned on Seymour Island and came looking for your ship after all radio calls went unanswered."
"That would have been Mae Fletcher's party," she said quietly. "I suppose they're all dead, too."
"Two passengers and the crewman who took them ashore," he answered. "Miss Fletcher and the rest are alive and well." For a brief instant, her face took on a series of expressions that would have done a Broadway actress proud. Shock was followed by anger, culminating in a slow change to happiness. Her eyes brightened and she visibly relaxed.
"Thank God Maeve is all right."
The sunlight came through the windows of the lounge and shone on her hair, which was loose and flowing about her shoulders, and he caught the scent of her perfume. Pitt sensed a strange mood change in her. She was not young, but a confident woman in the prime of her early 30s, with strong inner qualities. He also felt a disconcerting desire for her that angered him. Not now, he thought, not under these circumstances. He turned away so she wouldn't see the rapt expression on his face.
"Why?" she asked numbly, gesturing around her. "Why did they all have to die?"
He stared at the 8 friends who were enjoying a special moment before their lives were so cruelly stolen from them. "I can't be totally certain," he said in a voice solemn with rage and pity, "but I think I have a good idea."